Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report Business Roundtable. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. The S&P was down last week on better-than-expected U.S. jobs numbers, strong commercial air traffic and cargo growth. Boeing awards its outgoing CEO a nearly $32 million pay package, a 45% rise, as it looks for a new boss. This as industry debates why a new jetliner would cost Boeing $50 billion to develop. After a century as one of the world's biggest conglomerates, GE Aerospace is now a standalone company, having spun off its GE Vernova power business. NATO has proposed playing a more central role in arming Ukraine. Britain considers an arms embargo on Israel after British humanitarian workers were killed in an Israeli airstrike in Gaza. And on the eve of the Navy's biggest annual conference, the Navy Secretary is criticizing his shipbuilders for being behind schedule and over budget on all of its programs. This, as the Navy itself, is central to anything that its shipbuilders do. Joining me today to discuss all this and more are Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Securities, Sash Tusa of the independent equity research firm Agency Partners, and Richard Alafia of the Aerodynamic Advisory Consultancy. Everybody, welcome back to the show. It's always a pleasure. Hope everybody had a great weekend. Ron, as ever, start us off, right? On one sense, good news. And of course, the street responds negatively to that good news. And for good reason, right? Jobs numbers were far stronger than anybody had expected. That in turn then drives concerns about, you know, okay, is the Federal Reserve, is the Fed going to consider the economy too hot to reduce interest rates? What were the drivers on the S&P overall on the week, and how did the group, Aerospace and Defense Group, perform?
Yeah, so this week, the market, the S&P was down about 1%, 95 basis points. And like you highlighted, I mean, it was primarily driven about concerns over the Fed, right? I mean, the market was expecting cuts from the Fed to just begin cutting interest rates, say in June, you know, call it this summer. And with the economy doing well, the argument goes, well, maybe the Fed doesn't have to do it so soon. And of course, that drives a negative reaction in the market. So down percent on the week is, you know, not great. When you look at across the group, it really was kind of mixed. So the star performer this week was GE Aerospace. Was up almost 12%. Some of that has to do with trading technicals of, you know, the company splitting up, so on and so forth. But when you think about, you know, where investors can look for a liquid, large cap aerospace name that's got good aftermarket exposure and doesn't have a lot of hair on it, there's not a lot, right? So that's, you know, part of it. But when you look across the group, Boeing was down 5%. General Dynamics was up almost 5%. You know, on the heels of the G700 getting certified. Textron, as another indicator of what's going on in the bizjet world, was up almost 1%. Embraer was down 4%. Raytheon Technologies was up, or excuse me, RTX was up 5%. And just, you know, kind of in sympathy with the GE thing. Lockheed was flat. Northrop was down about 5%. Booz Allen was down about 1%. So kind of the big takeaway there across the group was commercial, on average, outperformed with the exception of Boeing, and defense was down. Probably the story this week, and this is where some things started to change relative to some of our previous conversations. WTI crude was 87. Brent was over 91. Right. So usually our oil commentary is pretty boring, right? It's like range for a while. It seems like it's starting to move upwards. The 10-year yield, again, was at almost 4.5. And as we've been saying here for the last couple of weeks, it's been on this upward trend, and that's continuing. And that's, I think, one of the things that, you know, is kind of factoring into the market. And then also the VIX, which has been, you know, down around, you know, 12 or 13. And again, for folks who aren't familiar, the VIX is really this measurement of sort of fear and loathing in the market, was at 16. So the VIX is climbing too. So there's more risk aversion working its way into the market. And you know, I'm not a strategist, but, you know, clearly that's because of the macro around the Fed.
And, you know, you've got a lot of other dynamic factors as well, right? Concern about the outcome of the U.S. election. You've got the Gaza war that's continuing. You have a strike on the Iranians, right? So at what point, and the Israelis girding for a strike, right? And then you have the Ukraine wars going on, right? I mean, and the Baltimore Bridge collapse, right? And what impact does that have? Houthis, right? I mean, so it's globally, right? I mean, there are a lot of uncertainties if you're an investor, aren't there?
Yeah, there clearly are. Yep, a lot of uncertainties, and then we're also, moving into spring and so on and so forth. So we'll see how it all plays out. But yeah, the uncertainties clearly are piling up.
A couple of days off for Easter and everybody comes back stressed out, which I always think is a very funny
But
is.
bear in mind, right? It's the beginning of the, from an investor perspective, the beginning of the second quarter.
Correct.
So, everybody kind of who, if their fiscal year end was the, the end of the first quarter, that year end's over, and now we're starting a new one for folks who are on that fiscal year.
Everybody's driven by their sheets and they're looking at what happened last quarter and how they're going to do this coming quarter. Sash, give us a sense from a European market standpoint, right? I mean, one of the big events in Europe was the commemoration of the 75th anniversary of the world's most successful political alliance with certainly military capabilities. We'll get to that in a second. But give us your sense on sort of the big drivers and how the group performed against them in Europe.
European markets actually were pretty weak during the week. Although I've got to say, just based on the number of bounce backs I've been receiving on emails, I don't think there's a lot of people at work because it's the week after Easter. And in fact, a lot of people, I think a lot of fund managers probably aren't going to come back to work until next week or the week after. And we've got to be aware that liquidity is really, really pretty low at present. But the numbers are that the UK market was flat off a bit, France and Germany percent. And then looking at the aerospace and defense sector in Europe, the civil companies were off 2%, defense companies were off just under 1%, with really two big standouts, I think. Rheinmetall, yet again, up 3%. That was the best performer of the week. And Hensoldt off 6%. Hensoldt had a really strong week the week before, just in the run-up to Easter, and I think it's probably worth averaging it out over a 2-week period, in which case it's up a bit. But Hensoldt closed the acquisition of the small German defense services company ESG, and that's good. They clearly got it at a given that they locked in the price back in December. That's looking pretty smart at the moment, but it probably isn't big enough to move the needle at this week. So, overall, low liquidity, bit of profit taking, particularly on the continent. And I wouldn't expect to see people starting to get terribly excited again and starting to move large amounts of money probably for another week or so. And with regard to NATO, you're absolutely right. I mean, that was one of the more interesting pieces of international news flow. But I have to confess, we didn't get a single incoming call about that during the week at all. It just went right over people's heads.
That's fascinating. Although we're going to dive a little bit deeper into that later in the show to sort of get your sense on the mechanics of what some of these proposals, right, that would be adopted ideally in July will broadly mean. Richard, right on the one hand, and Ron, nice little update there in terms of what air traffic numbers are and cargo numbers, both looking very good. And so hence the outlook for the industry is very good. We discussed this briefly last week because Dave Calhoun gave one interview after the announcement of his departure. And it was in that interview that he suggested that any new airplane that's developed by the company would cost $50 billion to develop. And that's caused a lot of debate in the industry. In part, there are folks who say, well, the A380 costs $30 billion. The 787 cost about the same amount of money to develop. What's Calhoun talking about? I would chalk that up to inflation and other factors, right? I mean, the A320 was more than, was 20 years ago, and the 787 was about 20 years ago, give or take. Give us your sense on how much, and we'll get to his pay package in a second as well. But I want to just start the discussion about, is $50 billion the right amount of money that it's going to take to develop a new aircraft, whether it's single aisle or twin aisle? Or, if Boeing is trying to do, right, it was trying to do that mid-market airplane where it is a twin aisle airplane for, all of the reasons that it helps get people off the airplane faster, yada, 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 yada. Anyway, take it in any direction you want to take it.
Yeah, I think it's possible to overthink these things. It's the figure simply came from a repulsive mixture of incompetence and greed. The incompetence reflects a complete ignorance of anything to do with this beloved industry. The greed is, well, the idea that you should scare people away from launching anything for fear that, you know, any kind of spending on engineering or R&D would somehow damage the cherished Shock stock price. Well, even more than he and his management already has.
So you think this was price gaming on a guy who just got a massive stock package, right? $1.4 million in salary and roughly $30 million in stock to try to push up the stock value by basically scaring everybody and saying, well, I guess if you want us to do it, it's going to cost $50 billion.
That is only 150% of the explanation. Yes, just gaming the system and, of course, driven by incompetence. If you actually look at the history, first of all, there's almost universal agreement this would be a single aisle jet. And no, other than the 737 MAX horror, and even that was only in the 20s, you know, it is generally not possible to get a single aisle jet to cost more than, well, okay, with inflation somewhere in the mid-teens, and that would be with a lot of inflation. You know, I mean, Bombardier was almost broken by the experience of developing the C-Series for, what, $6 billion? Mm-hmm. As Brother Ron will cheerfully point out, Embraer could do any of this well into the single digits just because they're super good. So if things got really super ambitious for a single aisle, maybe 20 for looking at a family. And that's with a fair amount of inflation adjustment going, you know, to the A350 XWB, the most recent clean sheet in the industry. I would point out that was somewhere in the teens, including all of the, you know, earlier incarnations of it. Very successful. So $50 billion comes, I would argue, from, you know, a complete ignorance of the business coupled with that gaming the system thing.
Ron, what's your sense, since you're both the only aerodynamic engineer and aerostructures engineer on this call?
Yeah, I about fell out of my seat when I heard $50 billion. I mean, that really kind of makes no sense. You know, okay. I agree with Richard. A number we've thrown around is 30, and that's building in a lot of room for screw ups. So if you look at so Boeing's last two airplanes, the MAX and the 787, they were both grounded after 18 months going into service. They both had production halts. So if you kind of factor all that into the development cost, broadly speaking, and that's kind of how we think about the 30 number. But you know, if you were to not mess it up, or if you were to just kind of modestly, you know, Richard's 20 number, but probably should be less than that. I mean, honestly, 15, and it really depends on, you know, is it a two-member family, is it a three-member family, how innovative are you really going to be, are you going to try to do, like, you know, a whole new fuselage and this, that, and the other thing, what materials are you going to use, is it going to be a high wing, is it going to be a low wing, are you going to do, you know, unducted fan, are you going to do a more traditional potted engine, that kind of stuff, are you really going to go off the reservation and do a blended wing body? I mean, so there's a lot of variations on it, but $50 billion is, you know, this is just a massive, ridiculous kind of number. So, I mean, it's just insane.
Could it be a broader ecosystem number that it's going to cost everybody, right? I mean, so is he, I'm just trying to give him the benefit of the doubt here, right?
No.
I mean, is that an all-up cost for
no
the engine makers? There?
No, it's not. I mean, and Richard brings it up. So, just to put this in perspective. So, the probably the best being most efficient, getting stuff done on time airplane company in the world today is Embraer. If you roll back the clock, they did the E1 170, 175, E1 190, 195, four variants of an airplane with two different tails, two different wings, right? So it wasn't just one wing with a bunch of different fuselage barrels. I mean, there was reasonable differences between the airplanes. They did that whole family for about $1.7 billion, and that was approximately 20 years ago, maybe a little less than that. And so if you,
and those are great
planes. And if you would account for inflation and so on and so forth, you know, you double that, that's 3.5, add some inflation, maybe 4 or 5. So, you know, could Embraer do like a new family of narrow bodies in that kind of $4 to $6 billion range? Yeah. If you were to put a multiple of 3 or 4 on that for a Boeing or an Airbus, that probably seems reasonable, and that gets you to the number that Richard said, around 20, and then roll on top of that maybe some other stuff like we've seen, and maybe right, you're at 25. But 50? No, that's really sort of just a ridiculous number.
Sash, what's your sense on this, given that you've got a little bit of experience looking at all this stuff over the decades as well?
I agree with Richard and Ron. 20 billion, I mean, even 30 billion seems insanely high. That would include so many foul-ups that all management heads would roll for that, particularly for a narrow body. 20 billion, I think, is a number that would include an immense amount of ecosystem investment. I mean, the thing that will cost for the next narrow body, and I agree with Richard, this is going to be a narrow body, is going to be that the thing is probably going to be very, very, very composite and very room temperature composite rather than autoclaves. And certainly, you know, an Airbus is spending well over $1 billion a year just on trying to develop these technologies. Boeing is probably underspent on this, and Boeing has less, you know, so the leap from the 737 to the next generation is probably going to be a bigger leap in terms of manufacturing technology. Although clearly they've gone through all that process with the 787. But, you know, 20 billion, I would think, is absolutely, you know, the top end of what management should be aiming for. So why the 50 billion? Two things. One, Mr. Calhoun, for reasons, is trying to dissuade us investors from Boeing doing it. I mean, he's trying to say, I was right not to invest in the next generation aircraft. I think that's absolutely shameful. Actually, I really do. You're running, he was running, still is, the, you know, one of the world's most important and biggest civil aircraft companies. Your job, his job, is to build civil aircraft. And build means not just knock out something that was designed in the 1960s, but design and build more. So, you know, that's just an unacceptable argument. Second issue, or point I would make is, if the next generation narrow body to be built by Boeing is going to be that expensive, what on earth has he been doing on the board for the last decade and lots, doing all these share buybacks? He, as a lead investor in Boeing, should have been saving this money for the next generation aircraft. He shouldn't have been giving it back to investors to juice up the share price. That is absolutely unacceptable behavior. So I just don't understand where this number comes from. And the more that I've looked at it, the more I think that the arguments for it are unacceptable.
And I don't suppose any of you buy the argument that some make, including our close mutual friend Charles Armitage at Citi, that there could be a case to be made that the company may want to go a little bit slower in starting a new airplane, given, you know, that the technologies themselves may be very different when this new airplane comes around, that there could be a little bit of prudence in sort of going a little bit slower than moving a little bit faster. Ron, why don't you take a bite? Or Richard, whoever wants to take a bite at that. Well, yeah. Ron, why don't you go? Because, right, I mean, we turn to you a little bit more for technology. Richard, you'll lead off the next point. But I just want to give you kind of a, just weigh in on that.
Yeah, I don't agree with that whatsoever. None. You know, I mean, are we going to be flying on hydrogen powered airplanes on the next generation of airplanes? No. Are we going to be flying on electric powered airplanes? I mean, and then I'm talking, you know, call it large commercial class airplanes. No, we're not. I mean, the next generation of airplanes will have a more traditional architecture engine, and maybe even the generation after that. So no, I don't buy that at all. And the simple fact is, you know, do you have to deliver airlines a 30 to 50% improvement? No, right? I mean, if you can give airlines, say, a 7% improvement over what they have today, or a 10% improvement over what they have today economically, that makes gobs of sense. And in particular, if you can, you know, do things in terms of maintenance and interiors and aerodynamics and all kinds of stuff. So no, I don't buy that. Not at all. I think that's just an absolute cop-out.
And it's interesting that actually, if you look at the history of the business, right, it's each one of these trade-offs and relatively incremental as we're kind of like moving up, you know, every once in a while, there's like a lurch forward, but everything is, you know, a calculation of, you know, speed, number of passengers, right, or, you know, overall, you know, so I mean, it's so many other dynamic factors to this. And, you know, the incrementalism has actually suited most people pretty well at the end of the day. And indeed, we've seen instances where, you know, when you are the de Havilland and you come up with a comet and it's a break ahead, it's often better to be the follower in this necessarily than the person who's leading it. Richard, let's discuss the elephant in the room, right? Boeing's proxy statement is out. I think their big meeting is correct me if I'm wrong, May 14, something like that. And in this was contained the $32 million compensation package for Dave Calhoun. His pay is $1.4 million. So this is largely in stock. It, you know, he wouldn't be able to sell it for a while. If he leaves early, the number would be a little bit smaller. You know, obviously a lot of commentary on that, given that he's been on the company's board since 2009. We can argue that some of the language in the proxy is a little saccharine, frankly, about the extraordinary role he's played at the company. Anyway, Richard, why don't you start us off on the conversation? I don't think it's a surprise. Executives are compensated, perhaps overcompensated in today's system and in stock often. Even if there are some people who feel he doesn't deserve any compensation after what happened, or indeed a penalty like car makers, right? You know, I remember when, you know, recalls would happen and Alan Mulally got a dent in his wallet because he had to give money back, you know, as a mutual friend explained it. Anyway, take it away.
I would urge everyone to read this document because the saccharine, you know, that doesn't really cover it. It's a masterclass in sycophancy. It's just utterly hilarious as a document. It's also extremely amusing to see that Calhoun is getting three times as much as his nearest, you know, operating unit heads at Boeing. Not that, you know, well, some of them are, some aren't bad. Some are pretty useless, but either way, a 3x multiple for doing nothing. It's pretty impressive. I guess this just goes to show that there's just this enormous salary that comes from just showing up at the very top ranks. Because, you know, did Alan Mulally earn anything like this? I don't think so. Was he 30 or 40 times better? Absolutely. There doesn't appear to be a lot of virtuousness built into these compensation models. It just is a matter of power or something. And, you know, the other interesting aspect is that the whole thing is peppered with him not getting this incentive thing, which would have been $2 million. So basically, they paid him $32 million because they felt like it, I guess. And but real slap on the wrist with a wet noodle, not getting that $2 million. So sorry, what was that not getting the $2 million for? Well, we all know why there should be, you know, some kind of decrement in pay here, grotesque incompetence and not showing up, I'm thinking. But somehow the other $32 million is perfectly, you know, acceptable. You know, to quote Brother Sash, not acceptable. This is acceptable. The company needs to change. Have a nice day. End of story.
Although they would say that, you know, he has stood up more and conveyed better emotions and internally has maybe done somewhat better than his predecessor and predecessors did, even if he was on the board for a long, certainly a long period of time and was party to some of the decisions that got us in this mess in the first place and led to the crashes and everything else. But then you can make a case for poor board oversight, which unfortunately in many cases in the document obviously spends a lot of time talking about the composition of the board and its, you know, engineering acumen, its industrial acumen and the like. And you could argue in some respects that those are correct. Sash, your take on this.
Sorry, if I could just add one other thing.
Sure.
If you don't mind.
I don't mind.
Three,
you
two,
never have to ask, Richard. On this show, you never have to ask.
I think at this rate of pay, this also explains why he wants to hang around for the next 9 months. I mean, when you think about it, if you can, you know, pull that kind of muscle or whatever and say, gee, I deserve another, you know, 30-something million dollars, you're not going to do the right thing and get out of the way. So this whole thing is kind of an atrocity.
Right. I mean, and there are those who've said that, you know, given the overall performance, you know, he should not be involved in picking his successor. And indeed, there are some names floating around. Greg Smith, former CFO of the company, is mentioned again in among the many names that you're hearing swirl in the course of this. And again, point out that Stephanie Pope has not relinquished her post as the chief operating officer of the company. Sash, your take, and Ron, yours before we move on. Go ahead.
I mean, I've got very little to add to what Richard said, but I mean, this is a payment for failure, and it's up to the shareholders to decide whether that's a payment that they want to tolerate or not.
Ron?
Yeah, it's a you know, interesting question. I would say it's a failure of corporate governance, right? In the end, it's the board that sets this stuff up. If you just kind of peel back and look at what has happened at the company, you know, Boeing this year is the sixth worst performing stock in the S&P 500. You look at where production is, you look what's going on and everything that's happened. And then later this year, you have a important negotiation with the IAM in Seattle region. My guess is more likely than not, there's probably going to be a strike, but we'll see. Right. So when you look at where Boeing's shares were about $330 a share when he took over the company, and now they're at 183. So pretty much on every, just call it naked performance metric, it hasn't gone well. To some extent, the CEO shouldn't or isn't the guy that decides his pay. It's the board, and the board sets up all the incentives and everything. So if one is unhappy with, performance and pay, that all goes back on the board. And that goes back to, something we wrote earlier this week that, the company's got to change. And part of that change is not just a change in the management ranks, but also a change in the board ranks.
But I mean, isn't that part and parcel when you put a lot of former and current CEOs on? They're all looking at it exactly the same, aren't they? I want my big payout package, whether the company craters or not.
Hence, right? My point,
I get rewarded.
Right? No, hence my point. That's just a failure of corporate governance.
Right. I believe many people would agree with you on that, meaning no disrespect to the individuals involved in the decision making. But let's shift gears a little bit. Sash, I want to, just real quick, let's talk about GE. Right after a century as one of the world's largest conglomerates and, an iconic brand for everything from light bulbs to appliances to, gearboxes for ships to, go on, almost, industrial power wind turbines, financing of aircraft, the first American maker of jet engines, and a company synonymous, right, for many decades with the ruthlessness, Jack Welch ruthlessness and shareholder return. GE Aerospace is now under Larry Culp's leadership as a standalone company. GE Vernova, the power business, spun off the medical unit, spun off last year. Just some thoughts, at this key moment. Honestly, the company and companies both are valued extraordinarily well, right? So, I mean, this isn't sort of an enfeebled company that's emerging from this. Ron, maybe if you want to sort of start us off real quick, get your sense on it before we move to the defense portion of the discussion. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, if you go back in the evolution of GE, when it was a broader conglomerate, it had worked itself into being, and I used to joke, a bank that made dishwashers. It got very, very, very heavy on the finance side, and that's ultimately got them in a lot of trouble. So if you look at what it is today, it's a lot simpler of an entity. And I think there's precedent for this. So, for example, when Northrop Grumman spun off its shipbuilding business, Huntington Ingalls has done better alone than it did under the auspice of Northrop Grumman. So by separating these different businesses, you allow management teams, sort of the obvious, to focus on those businesses. And a lot of the issues that GE had, I mean, there was some specific challenges within GE's energy portfolio and also the mix of businesses that they had. GE Aerospace itself was always a crown jewel and still is. So now you have a management team that can be focused on one P&L and growing it. One criticism there has been out there is, why get rid of the energy business? Because the energy business has, industrial gas turbines. That was a line of questioning I had for the company. And there is a relationship still with the separation of Vernova. on the gas turbine business in terms of product development to be done with GE Aerospace. So there is still some relationship there. So, however, GE Aerospace will be doing that development on a on a contract basis for, right, for Vernova. So they're not completely separated in that sense. But on its own, like I mentioned before, GE Aerospace is a fantastic portfolio, and it's really one of the few large cap names at this point that's a very clean story that can really just focus on execution, right, as opposed to RTX has all the challenges going on at Pratt and Whitney and some challenges in their defense business. Boeing, we spend a ton of time talking about it, but so when you think about it from just a U.S. investor perspective, in a large cap, liquid, well-positioned aerospace name, what else is there?
And again, Larry Culp trying to resuscitate and build on the core culture of engineering excellence being at the heart of every single thing they do, right? And the people and all of it will come from it, which I think is a good strategy. And
one of the things that jumped out to me, and I think this is very important and it's kind of resonated with the engineer in me, and they said this at the GE Aerospace Investor Day, that they're going to spend 6 to 8% of sales year in and year out on product development. There's very few large companies in our world that do that, particularly in the US. Maybe it's, right, a little different in Europe, but Boeing doesn't do that. And when I think about the companies that do that, Gulfstream's one of them, and Gulfstream's been very successful at what they do. So, right, this continual investment where you're not ramping up and ramping down and spinning in and spinning out and hiring contract engineers and firing contract engineers, just having consistency in product development will go a long way, has gone a long, right, way, and will continue to go a long way.
I just cannot, it was a visit last year to GE's upstate New York engineering campus, and it was extraordinary the kind of work that they're doing and the kind of thing, in my view, that always differentiates a company that's really serious from one that's not serious. More PhDs than almost anywhere in the country are concentrated there, and they're doing everything from materials work. I would give credit also to General Motors, has a similar sort of engineering campus with tens of thousands of engineers that are looking at everything from microelectronics to communications to all of the things that go into their products. And again, some of their foundational hypersonic work, whether on high temperature electronics, on materials, as well as propulsion, are the kind of things that I think are very encouraging as this move happens. Richard, and then Sash, go ahead.
Yeah, my God, this is a huge success story. It really is very impressive. And frankly, it makes it all the sadder that Larry Culp has told journalists that he doesn't want the Boeing job, because frankly, he'd be awesome at it. I understand why he wants to stay with his new creation. I totally get that. But boy, he's been transformational, because, second point, you contrast this tremendous success with where they came from. And anyone who's read, Lights Out or The Man Who Broke Capitalism or any of those great books about the origins and evolution of the old GE, the Jack Welch GE, knows that it was going to hell. There were any number of ticking time bombs embedded there. So you've got these new, far, as Ron said, cleaner, far more transparent structures, which are absolutely innovators and market leaders, especially our friends at Aero Engines. That's just extraordinary. So please, Larry Culp, maybe in a year or two, reconsider and go over to Boeing and do the same thing. But, the one thing that really hits you also, in addition to that consistency of R&D that Ron talks about and the implications for new product development capabilities and talent retention, again, opposite of Boeing, you've also got the remarkable power of, for want of a better term, friendship. You look at the importance of leverage and alliances in the aerospace business, and you look at their half-century-old relationship with Safran under the CFM consortium, and you just see just how things are better when you have friends and partners in this industry, and that goes for a long time. And I would argue that CFM is actually the single most successful transatlantic or even international partnership of any flavor, from cars to computers to whatever. It's pretty remarkable, and it's hard to identify any serious threats to it.
It is an extraordinary partnership, and indeed, right, you can tell that the people involved in it consider themselves friends. There are no surprises on either side, and both sides are totally committed to the success of the partnership in a really basic commercial sense as well, right? I mean, always a challenge whenever it's a Franco anything combination. And it's one that's good for the French state. It's good for the United States as well, ultimately, given, that it's, U.S. military aircraft are powered by those engines as well. Sash, your take on this before we have to go a little bit of lightning round on a couple of topics, many of which actually involve you. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, just very quickly, the point about GE spending 6 to 8% of R&D of sales on R&D every year. That is what you would expect a European aero engine company to be doing. So yeah, it's much more European than US in that respect. Aero engine companies in Europe tend to spend more than airframers. Airbus's R&D is more cyclical than the aero engine companies, although they're by no means immune to it. Airbus has varied between 4% and 10% of sales in that respect. But I mean, take a step back for a second. Here are companies in this bit of the industry that are spending very large amounts of money. I mean, these are large companies spending large amounts of money on very fundamental R&D. You made the point about the number of PhDs that you meet up at the GE engineering campus. You would find very similar at any of the European aerospace companies. But you'd also find something else, which is literally thousands of apprentices. The aerospace companies are among the biggest recruiters of apprenticeships or apprentices, particularly in the UK, but also in France and Germany. So the point I would make is these companies are genuinely doing good to the company, to the countries they operate in. They are creating more wealth. They are creating much higher quality jobs, much higher barriers to entry against particularly China than a lot of other industries. These really are companies that should be cherished by their governments and supported by their governments. And companies in this industry that don't behave like that, that don't spend on R&D and don't recruit well and don't support engineers and so forth, I think should be, their governments should look askance at them because they're not actually playing the game right and they're not repaying all of the support their government's given. Boeing, I'm looking at you again.
I just want to underscore that point, Sash. Compensation is not as high, even for extraordinary performance, although the U.S. emphasis, U.S. U.S. habits are beginning to cross the Atlantic. What I find interesting is, many of the most competitive European companies will say we're spending 20% of our top line revenue on that, in part because there isn't the defense commercial synergy there exists in the United States often, right? The programs are not as big that can offset them. And there is much more focus on this bread and butter, long-term blocking and tackling, and also having senior executives, whether it's Tom Enders, but many, many other ones across Europe that will say, look, I can't do a share buyback. I mean, I'd love to do that, but be realistic. Tom used to say this all the time, and I think he still remains a touchstone. It's your obligation as chief executive to educate your investors on what is reasonable rate of return and what is not. And he would regularly tell people, if you want unrealistic rates of return and businesses that are going to consume themselves and eventually trip up and not deliver you those returns over the long term, go to Boeing. But if you want to, invest in Airbus, we're going to be around 100 years from now making great products and employing great people, right? I think it's that sort of philosophical difference often you find in Europe that occasionally you don't find here. That's it. That's my little plug. Really quickly, Richard, before I go to Sash on the NATO meeting and Britain considering a potential arms embargo against Israel, just really quickly on the F-18s. I know we discussed this a little bit. I think we discussed more V-22s. We discussed the F-15EX as well. But just really quickly on the F-18, right? Every time we think the F-18 is down and out, Congress comes up and Ethereum throws a little bit more money at it, right? So now the line is extended till 2027. What's the real end of this line going to look like? Or is this something that, you know, are these programs going to be in production when we cross the threshold of the decade and beyond, in all honesty?
Yeah, you know, this is a big question because, of course, you've got the monoculture, if you will, of carrier aviation in the U.S. The price for not having a production carrier aircraft is potentially, you know, the loss of a carrier or two in a budget war, which is obviously not as bad as the loss of a carrier or two in a real war. But still, you know, you lose enough carriers in budget, you cease to have the case for a Navy dedicated combat aircraft, and you have to use something joint, which they don't want to do. They don't even like the F-35 Charlie model, of which they've only procured a couple of dozen. The rest are Marines. So Super Hornet is pretty much the only game in town. Yes, drones offer potential for one day, you know, strike missions, one day, decades hence. F-35C, again, not happening. And then we've got F-A-XX. Okay, that seems to be a lot further behind relative to NGAD. It's a heck of a bet that they will be able to deploy F-A-XX aircraft in the second half of the 2030s. A heck of a bet. So the question becomes, if they're refusing to take more Super Hornets, what happens? What is their, you know, what is their life raft in carrier aviation? Obviously, a block, you know, block three Super Hornet rebuild, SLBM, what have you, is a possibility, but it still renders you vulnerable to having, well, an inadequate number of jets. So all of this, is the 2027 base number for closing the line operational? Yeah, but we could be having a very different conversation in a couple of years.
I just want to point out, right, I mean, I think the Air Force is going to get to collaborative combat aircraft pretty quickly. The Navy has repeatedly demonstrated in groundbreaking ways that it can be an unmanned leader when it wants to be an unmanned leader. It just sort of doesn't want to be an unmanned leader. And so it's going into a very long range confrontation where systems are developed to push the carrier back with aircraft that are a little bit too short for the job. And I couldn't agree with you more, right? I mean, the Navy was in F-35 to kill F-35 if it could. Guys who are operating the Charlie recognize it's a tremendous capability on the carrier, but unfortunately, they don't have as many of them because the hope was we can get rid of this unpleasantness, this single engine unpleasantness, and get to a real carrier aircraft, right? Tomcat 2, as opposed to recognizing that it's a mix of unmanned, manned, and longer range aircraft will hold it in better stead than a lot of shorter range aircraft and aircraft that have more payload capability, which is why, you know, which you had with F-4 Phantoms, which you had with the F-14, and then which you didn't have with the F-18, even though the F-18 ENF was better than the A through Ds. So, alas. But real quick, Sash, NATO's 75th anniversary, a lot of discussion about a more central role for a NATO in the arming of Ukraine. There's a lot of activity that's going on at national levels, and some of this is being coordinated through NATO, but the European Defense Agency is working this as well, right? I mean, so there's a lot of activity to put these European defense factories to greater use. Still, the needle not moving as quickly as it necessarily should. But the United States and Germany, for example, are among the nations that think it's not a particularly good idea for NATO to be the one doing this. I think the Atlantic Alliance is playing a role, should play a role, and optically it doesn't change anything. You know, Russia is already accusing NATO of being at war with Russia, even though it's Russia that's at war with NATO. You know, walk us through the mechanics of some of this and how it changes the European rearmament picture, if at all.
Okay, so there's two slightly separate proposals that came out of the NATO summit and celebrations. One, that NATO should coordinate a $100 billion 5-year military aid program for Ukraine, which sounds, you know, I mean, it's a 3-digit billion number, so it sounds great. But of course, you know, even $20 billion a year, that doesn't keep Ukraine, that probably doesn't preserve Ukrainian territorial integrity at that price. Ukraine's air defense needs are probably nearly half of that. So it doesn't cover any of the rest, the artillery, the armored vehicles, the systems, the you know, all of the paraphernalia of defense. But still, it's a good proposal. And to coordinate that through NATO, the reason for that is that some European capitals and NATO's Secretary General Stoltenberg himself are reported to be trying to make this support for Ukraine much more independent of, I've got to say, a second Trump presidency. The worry is otherwise that if this support for Ukraine is done by a series of bilaterals and European nations probably don't pay their fair share, then Ukraine is incredibly vulnerable in the event that President Trump is re-elected in November. So that's proposal number one. And proposal number two, which is almost a subset of this, is the suggestion that NATO should take the lead in what's referred to as the Ramstein Group, which is effectively the coordination of supply of arms to Ukraine. So slightly different. It's not funding it, but where individual European nations and the US have had equipment that they want to send to Ukraine, the Ramstein Coordination Group has tended to be the organization that helps that process happen. None of this is actually about rearming Europe itself. This is very, very Ukraine-focused, but NATO is acutely aware that NATO has to be credible over the next few years, particularly in the event of a second Trump presidency, because otherwise NATO members are very, very vulnerable to Russian attacks. So this is, you know, in that respect, I think what this is about trying to bring a much greater sense of realism of NATO burden sharing in NATO, and that's something we've heard through most of our careers, and Europe being a much more equal member, European countries being a much more equal member of NATO, rather than just being, tagging along while the US does the majority of the effort. Here's the problem. The Russians have got a fantastic info ops line, which is NATO is attacking us. And that's repeated in various ways. And that plays very, very well. But even in Germany, Germany and the US have been diverging very slightly politically on this. And it was very interesting that German Defense Minister Pistorius last week actually said to the German defense chiefs, we're going to have a full-blown defense review, and you have got to be prepared for the reintroduction of conscription in Germany if that's what politicians want. Boy, if you said that in the UK, I mean, there would be, you know, place would just go mad, because that is an incredibly radical thing to say for a nation that really has only embraced a professional armed forces in the last 20-odd years or so. But, you know, Defence Minister Boris Pistorius gets it. He realises that you have to have the ability to raise a citizen's army in the event that things go very, very badly wrong, and he's starting that now. And I think huge credit to him for that. And I think that we will hear these calls for conscription on an individual national basis, because, you know, whether you like it or not, Europe is a collection of individual countries. We all have our different idiosyncrasies, but I think that's going to become much, much more widely heard over the coming year, 18 months, 2 years or so.
And let me take you to the question of the debate in the UK about an arms embargo on Israel in the wake of the strike that left British humanitarian workers dead. They were working for World Central Kitchen. But I believe that there have also been others over the course of this campaign. Give us a sense on where this is going. Critics say Israel is being heavy-handed and indiscriminate in the way it's conducting strikes. The Israeli answer is this is very hard. There are terrorists all around, and we're trying to eradicate Hamas, although there appears in this case this convoy was vetted, was approved, and was a pretty sustained series of strikes on it, and unfortunately killing all those involved. Anyway, give us your sense on where, what direction this debate is going in the UK.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the events themselves were as horrible as all these attacks on civilians, but particularly on aid workers are. And I think it's very interesting that the Israeli Defense Force have actually sacked the, I think it's the Brigade Fire Control cell commander and a couple of other commanders. So there appears to be some acceptance by the Israeli Defense Force that either processes were not followed properly or they were very, very gung-ho in terms of the targeting that was going on. But the problem, I think, has been, you know, support for Israel and how Israel is managing the campaign in Gaza has been declining all across or across a lot of Europe, but particularly in the UK. UK politicians have been very supportive of Israel, but that's weakening and has been weakening a lot so the longer this conflict's been going on. Once you start killing British aid workers, whether or not there are terrorists interspersed with them or not, you lose a ton of additional support. So there are now calls for a British an embargo on British arms sales to Israel. Well, let's look at the numbers. Chump change, 30-40 million pounds, dollars a year, and it's been pretty stable over the last 10-15 years. That's going to have precisely zero effect on Israel's military efforts, but it's a big political statement to make, in particular because the UK is a member of the permanent member of the UN Security Council. So, you know, we all know what follows next. I think the other thing that's going to be very, very interesting is that some politicians are saying that arms embargoes play both ways, that not only will the UK not supply weapons to Israel, but we won't buy from them either. Now, most Israeli sales of weapons to the UK or defence equipment to the UK actually come through onshore companies, particularly Elbit Systems UK business, which has got a manufacturing and assembly set up here. So there may be a hope that, you know, that can be used to sort of dodge around depriving UK armed forces of needed Israeli equipment. I actually don't think that's going to wash. And that's going to be a really interesting test of onshore production and whether it's politically acceptable or not. But effectively, political support for Israel has been dealt an enormous blow in the UK by these attacks. And by just, you know, the optics were dreadful, even by the standards of a horrible war. And I think that, you know, it may take a couple of weeks to play out either way. And apparently there is disagreement between Prime Minister Rishi Sunak and Foreign Secretary David Cameron on this. But, you know, this really does highlight the increased pressure that's got, or the increased loss of support for Israel from otherwise very, very supportive allies.
And I think that's a problem also in Germany, by the way, which has always gone above and beyond in terms of being supportive of Israel, even when it's in tough spots. And again, a broader debate there, as well as in the United States, where the U.S. administration has tried to use friendship as a governor to cajole the Israelis to be more careful. And unfortunately, that's not been the case.
If I can just add to that very quickly, I think that if these had been German aid workers that had been killed, it would put almost intolerable pressure on the German government, which is trying to buy or is planning to buy the Israeli Arrow anti-tactical ballistic missile system from Israel. You know, that's an incredibly important part of the German rearmament and new air defences. And if Germany, decided that they couldn't buy Arrow from Israel, that would be a huge blow to Israel. And that would actually affect Germany's own defenses as well. So that, I think, is something to watch.
We are unfortunately almost out of time. Ron, really quickly, the Secretary of the United States Navy, right? I mean, there are budget hearings that are going to be coming up and there's going to be a lot of criticism. So every once in a while, when the Navy sees this, it decides it's a good time to throw its industry under the bus. He's begun criticizing his shipbuilders for being behind schedule and over budget on all of these programs, almost giving the impression that the United States Navy is a bystander in this when the Navy is actually intimately engaged at every level to a degree of intrusion that, you know, is not the case when it comes to aircraft manufacturing or even armored vehicle making. Chris Kastner of HII, the chief executive, did a great job talking to reporters last week you know, sort of like, look, you know, what are the factors and the dynamics, you know, saying the company still maintains a good relationship and partnership with the Navy, but walked us through what some of the challenges here are, whether they're manpower, you know, in some places we don't have the right kind of personnel, and actually told the good news story of the Navy's strategic investment to create a better pool of labor, to create a more diverse and stable form of suppliers. And Chris, you know, noted, hey, when it comes to demand, there's going to be a lot of demand, which is why we've seen the ship construction and maintenance budget go from, you know, $15 billion up to more than $30 billion over the last couple of years. Anyway, what do you sense when you see folks like the Navy Secretary, who many people say knows better, but again, we can understand sort of the political reasons for doing it, however disingenuous they might be. I mean, how do you regard this as somebody who covers the industry, covers the space? And, you know, there are a lot of very serious people, right? I mean, one of the great things about people in the shipbuilding business is everybody is pretty passionate about shipbuilding, right? There are not many people who get into shipbuilding because they're not passionate about it, right? To your point, right? Great note on Boeing. Whoever the new CEO is has got to be passionate about airplanes. Anyway, take it away.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't think this is lost on anybody. You know, one of the big challenges for the shipbuilders has been workforce. Think about it. I mean, the shipbuilding in general was de-emphasized for a long while. Correct me if I'm wrong, Vago, but we even stopped building nuclear submarines for about 6 years. And then you turn the opposite direction, and then you say to yourself, or you know, the nation says to itself, oh, wow, we're going to need more ships. You just can't turn it back on, particularly on the workforce front. You know, one of my
that,
favorite...
And that certainly was the case in the UK, right? Which did take a bit of a holiday and then ended up paying a terrible price. Sash, you did some terrific work over the years on that. But
it's like simple numbers, right? You know, a master pipe fitter in a shipyard can take 5 or 6 years to gain that skill set. Okay, fine. But now you're confronted with a workforce, and this, I think, confronts the entire industry, not just the shipbuilders, but I mean, you know, almost every industry, but it's particularly acute in aerospace because of the skill sets required. You have a younger generation of employees who don't have the mindset of, you know, their predecessors, where, you know, they'll get a job, they'll work in the line for 30, 35 years, they'll retire, they'll have a pension, that's what they do. You have a much more portable workforce. So attracting and retaining talent is critical. You know, one of the things they don't hide this fact. If you look at the number of people that Huntington Ingalls hires and the number of people that they lose, it's, you know, it's hard for them to, you know, gain beachfront because of the ability not to retain people. And that's not their fault. When you really want to work in a shipyard under, you know, the conditions, a lot of times outdoors, a lot of times in not great weather, where you could drive an Uber, as an example, or work someplace else, particularly when you're part of a generation that has a more portable mindset about, you know, loyalty to an employer and so on and so forth. So I think one of the answers to this, and this isn't, you know, any, you know, individual, what I'm trying to be clear about, this isn't an individual shipyard's fault. You have to have a procurement system that is sensitive to the realities of the current workforce challenges. And, you know, part of that's going to be better pay. Part of that's going to be working on strategies to retain employees in an environment where you have employees that their current mindset is actually not to be retained. They want to be portable and want to be able to move around. So, you know, they're going to have to think through and work through that. One part of that will be probably greater pay. Who knows? Maybe another part of that is pensions or whatever, you know, the current generation wants. But that's things they're going to have to think through. Now, you know, I guess the good news is, and we've seen more press on this, you have more and more young folks who are like, do I want to go to college or do I want a manufacturing job? And it seems like there's a bit of a shift going on, because when you look at the economics of a college education today, it's not so obvious that, you know, going and spending whatever it's going to cost you to get that liberal arts degree is actually going to pay off, as opposed to being high trained technical personnel working in a manufacturing or trade industry. So it seems like the wind is blowing in the right direction, but there's going to have to be more work on the workforce front. And that's a much broader problem than any one shipyard can address.
It was interesting listening to Chris talk about that, because they're looking at salary, right? I mean, you could do fast food now and make as much money as somebody who's just starting off in the industry. Obviously, they're looking at better compensation and different forms of compensation and incentives, both to retain people, but then reward them for great performance and figure out management track and other sorts of things to do. And I also thought what was interesting is they're applying AI to figure out, you know, hey, when we hire from these places, they stay. When we hire from these other places, they are all about portability and getting those skills and going someplace else, right? So
it in perspective, Vago, right? Think about this for a moment. And this is no exaggeration. You know, my daughter worked scooping ice cream in New Jersey. And the wage she was making at minimum wage plus tips, she'd be making more than she would be as a starting salary in a shipyard. So, I mean, I don't know. Maybe would you rather scoop ice cream or work in a shipyard? And particularly if you're not concerned that, oh, I'm not going to be there for 30 years. You know, this is just a couple of year engagement. Which one are you going to pick?
Well, and one is hot, dangerous, highly skilled work. And you're right. You're outdoors. It's hard work. It's also not easy to automate that, right? Many of the skills are manual skills at the end of the day. All right, everybody, thanks very much for joining us again. I just want to stress this as we, get into Navy League. By the way, Ron, really quickly, are there things in particular you're looking forward to hearing at Navy League this week from senior leaders?
Yeah, more on what we just discussed, right? I mean, I think probably the biggest single challenge across the industry and across not just the Navy, but the defense enterprise and even commercial aerospace is retaining talent and figuring out innovative strategies to do that. So I think that the firm or firms that figure that out will have a distinct advantage.
And Richard, right? I mean, everybody has a tendency of thinking this as a shipbuilding fest and a ship fest. It's also about naval aviation and submarines and all the other naval information and AI and everything else. What are some of the things you're looking forward to hearing from naval aviation leaders in particular?
Yeah, of course, any news flow on FAXX, any news flow on MQ-25, UJTS, there's that's kind of interesting, of course, because they've accelerated the replacement for the T-45 carrier training jet. And yet there appears to be a very aggressive schedule to procure those, but without the necessary cash to, decide what they want and develop the system and everything like that. So I think we're going to be looking very closely at how that program is moving forward. It's one of the few new airframes out there, right? So it's kind of interesting.
And absurdly an airframe that they insist does not need to be able to land on an aircraft carrier, which I think is absurd.
Yeah, that's
kind of, I think that's absurd. It has to have a tail hook and you need to be able to land it on the aircraft carrier. And that's that. But anyway, fascinating. Everybody, thanks very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. I hope you guys have a great what's left of the weekend. Have a great week. Looking forward to having you back on again next week. Thanks so very much. A quick word from our sponsors before we go. The Defense and Aerospace Report and its family of publications is brought to you by Bell, HII, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, GE Aerospace, Leonardo DRS, American Rheinmetall, and TE Connectivity. And please check out our award-winning weekly podcasts, Cavas Ships, hosted by our own Chris Cavas and Chris Cervello, and sponsored by HII and GE Aerospace, who clear the fog on naval and maritime matters. The Downlink with Laura Winter, sponsored by TE Connectivity, who takes a thoughtful look at all things space, and our Air Power podcast, sponsored by GE Aerospace, that I co-host with our own JJ Gertler. Thanks very much again for tuning in. We'll see you again tomorrow for the Look Ahead podcast, where Byron Callen of Capital Alpha Partners takes a look at the week ahead and whatever else is on his mind. And we're going to be joined by Chris Cavas and Chris Cervello of Cavas Ships to give us a look ahead at what they expect to hear at the Navy League's annual Sea Airspace Conference and Trade Show. Look forward to seeing you again tomorrow. And until then, have a great day.